We are now recording to the cloud. The audio recording as well as the deck will go up on our website. And I will mute all, and everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. If you want to chime in with a question or comment at any time, please feel free to do so. Please remute yourself afterwards so that we don't have too much background noise going on during the going through the deck. And with that, I'll kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Chris. Yeah, we have some prepared material tonight, but there's going to be lots of time, I think, for your computer-related questions. So I put a note to add those to the chat, and we'll get to them later on. Okay, to start off with a follow-up from last week, I'd indicated that the Americans had a program to try and cut down on the number of robocalls we all have to live with. And I asked if anybody was willing to follow up, and it turns out I was willing to follow up because nobody else did. As you see here, they're scheduling September this year when phone companies have to refuse traffic if the incoming call isn't listed in their robocall mitigation database. And it turns out that the industry has developed a couple of options to try and combat spam calls, and they're called STIR and SHAKEN. And STIR, as you see in the footnote here, is Secure Telephone Identity Revisited. And SHAKEN is a bit more of a weird acronym, signature-based handling of asserted information using tokens. And apparently, interestingly enough, these two acronyms, you have to work at getting the second one, but they're based on the James Bond preference for dry martinis. Anyway, basically, the intention is that these systems will match the caller ID, which will follow the call through the system to an actual phone number. So, in other words, it's trying to prevent spoofing. And this is the Americans again, the FCC saying our message is clear, certify the steps you're taking to stop legal robocalls or we will block your calls. So it sounds like they're serious about it, how good it is and how long it takes the spammers to work around it, I guess time will tell. I was kind of interested when I read this what Canada was doing, and it turns out if you put SHURE and SHAKEN and into Google and add the word Canada, you get a whole raft of hits. And one of them is right here from an organization called IT World Canada, and they tell me that STIR and SHAKEN is supposedly coming to Canada in June. So if that's true, we'll be ahead of the Americans. Anyway, if you're interested in seeing what's going on in the robocall prevention world, there's lots of information available on the web. Okay, a share here from Stuart about compasses. He points out there's lots of compass apps for Android devices, but he likes this one called Compass Steel because it's simple and it doesn't have any ads and it's free. And he says, why do you need an app rather than a real compass? And he says, well, a real compass only gives you magnetic north, and this app is a bit more flexible than that. But a real compass is good to have around, just in case you don't have cell phone coverage, I guess, or your GPS isn't working or whatever. Anyway, this is an app for Android devices. And if you check out the link in the Play Store, you'll find you can have all kinds of neat color themes for it. It gives you true north as well as magnetic north modes. You get the sun and the moon position, sunrise and sunset, so Tom will be happy. And you also get moonrise and moonset times. I'm sure those are very important to some people. Anyway, there you go, a compass app for your Android device. And that leads us on to more of Tom Trottier's favorites, because he had a whole bunch of apps which kind of lent themselves to this theme of outdoor living and hiking and that kind of stuff. So, Tom, I know you want to talk to these next three slides, because they're all apps that you you like.
He's gone. And you'll have to unmute yourself if you want to talk there, Tom.
Okay, here I am.
There you are.
So Komoot is basically, it gives you some cycling route. It has a membership component if you want, but the raw one will give you maps and so on. I'm not sure that it's so much better than Google Maps, but I've used it a number of times, and it seemed to give me nice routes that people would like, while Google Maps seems to prefer bicycle paths, even if they take you way out of your way. Besides GPS, this is an app that, if you really, really, really want to know very accurately where the heck you are, like within within a meter, Precise GPS does that by registering the GPS continuously, and then does the statistical analysis of the positions, and then it zeroes in on exactly where you are. GPS can be very precise, although some GPS proceeds. Receivers can use phase changes and other things that will actually get you very accurate. In fact, there are some accurate GPS receivers that will get you down to millimeter and centimeter accuracy, and they're used for surveying, and I think they're also used in agriculture to machines like combines very accurately.
Tom, your stuttering problems and that have not gone away.
I did try them out. And this is a different set of headphones, by the way. But I had the stuttering on both this and my other headphones. Maybe I should switch. Maybe I'll do that in between. Maps.me, the main advantage of Maps.me is that it gives you offline maps. You can download maps by basically political territory, like province and state. And sometimes there are several maps depending on the size. But you can download these very easily. It does have a lot of information on there. It doesn't have the concurrent stuff like traffic, like Google Maps does. But if you're going to a place where you don't have a cell phone connection, then you can download maps with Google, but you can also use Maps.me. It does have a bunch of information, and it works quite well. You can also do routes and stuff like that, and you don't need a cell phone connection. So if you're going into the deepest wilds of Quebec and you only have an Ontario cell phone, this might be useful, or other things like that. I don't think it has the satellite pictures, but it has all the maps and navigation, and it does have a variety of points of interest that it updates. You also update this. It's not automatically updated. You actually choose when to update it, which is, of course, usually when you go on a trip.
And the maps it's using there are OSM is OpenStreetMaps. So they're free maps, and they're actually really good.
They are
available worldwide.
Yes, and they also are, OpenStreetMaps also, the project, they try to get people to contribute local stuff and information into it. I mean, I suppose Google does too, but I think that that sort of thing is more used in when you're all way off the beaten path in Kenya or Bangladesh or someplace. It may have better information than Google Maps for some places.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And I have an additional Android app. This one called Walk Meter, and it's basically a mapping application. It's really designed for walkers and runners and cyclists, I guess, hikers. And it basically it gives you maps, and then it gives you all kinds of statistics about your journey. And the thing I like about it is that if all you want to do is find out how far you've gone, then you don't have to sign up to a website. You don't have to join the club and share your data with 10 million people. And it's just an app that uses your GPS on your smartphone to tell you how far you've gone. And if that's all you want, it works really, really well. And as an example here, here's a walk around the block. So you can see that in 28 minutes or so, I covered 2.6 kilometers. And you can see the track there around the local OpenStreetMap. That's Google Maps. And then you can see one of the charts there, which means something to somebody, but means very little to me. And it's doing a pace thing with pace per kilometer. It's like a reverse miles per gallon type metric, which personally I don't find very useful. But again, if all you want to know is how long you were out and how far you went and where you went, you've got a route map there. And it's an excellent little application, perfectly free and worked offline.
Does it have elevations as well?
It has elevations as well, right? So this is a share from Chris.
Yeah, so Kevin Stratford, I've talked about him in the past. He's had tips on the ones I've shared have been his Word tips and his PowerPoint tips. And this is one he put out just in the last couple of weeks on using Excel pivot tables. And for anybody who's not aware, if you have a bunch of data that is in Excel, you can slice and dice it all kinds of different ways. And pivot tables are a wonderful way to be able to look at your data from different viewpoints and so forth. I find them extremely powerful, but they take a little bit of time to get used to exactly what's going on. Well, Kevin has a bunch of tips for how you can use Excel pivot tables more effectively and some of the behind-the-scenes type things that maybe a lot of people don't really come across. So if you're interested in being able to slice and dice data, I highly recommend that you look at pivot tables, and Kevin Stratford's YouTube video can be very, very helpful to getting the most out of pivot tables. So that, as well as all his probably hundreds of other tips and tutorials and so forth that he's got on YouTube, I highly recommend them if you're interested in the particular topic.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And this was a question about the famous Unchecky utility.
Yeah, I put together the slides here, but I first came across Unchecky through Alan, actually, first mentioned it to me years ago. And what Unchecky actually does is it watches as you install software. And if you look at the screenshots on the right-hand side, this is some app, you know, QIP 2012, so this is off of the Unchecky website. And if you just click on the typical installation, what you actually get is what's selected in the ones below, which is what you can see if you actually go into custom install. And so you'll see that it changes your default homepage and it changes your search engine. And maybe that's something you didn't really want. And so Unchecky looks for those checked boxes that are kindly there to help you out and provide you with all kinds of things you don't want typically, and it will uncheck them for you. So it's not foolproof, but maybe it helps. And the result on that, you hope, is that you get no unwanted software installed as you install something completely unrelated to what they're foisting on you. And you end up with no unwanted changes to your configuration. And I say, no, well, you know, maybe, maybe not. So then that came up the question about Unchucky's support. And so from the Unchucky website, it says that it updates itself automatically. Install and forget it. Unchucky will automatically update whenever a new version is available, so you don't have to worry about whether you're running the latest version. That's right off their website verbatim. Well, it was last updated 3 years ago. So it may be updating itself every time a new version is available, but boy, there hasn't been a new version available in a long time. So I attempted to contact the author. It's Reason Security, Reason Core Security, Reason Software Systems. The company seems to go under a number of different names. They are still around, the company, but any attempt I had of contacting the author to see if it's still supported were unsuccessful. They do have a blog, and the blog for Unchucky actually has some recent postings on there, like within the last month or two. So there are people who are actively using the blog to share information or ask questions. I posted something, I guess a little over a week ago, saying, is Unchucky still supported? And mentioning that it hadn't been updated in 3 years. And so far I've had no response on the blog. So I'm looking at it now as being maybe it'll never get updated, but you know, the website still exists. You can still download the program. And the question is, you know, it doesn't really matter if it gets updated. First off, is it safe? So typically in security software in particular, you want to be up to date on it. You don't want it to be looking for the latest vulnerabilities and things like that. Well, Unchucky, you know, what is it doing? It's unchecking boxes for you. So is it likely to actually cause any problem? I don't think so. You know, I don't think it's going to harm your computer if you continue to use it. Then comes the question, is it going to be useful? Well, that is a little bit more of an open question, I think. So I say maybe, and I think it really depends on the approach that the company takes when it comes to looking for checkboxes to uncheck. So it might only help with software that was, you know, released 3 years ago or older. It might help with some newer software, because if they coded it to look for a checkbox, is it checked, and just blindly uncheck it, then it probably will continue to do the unchecking function in newer software. On the other hand, if they were actually looking to see what is the software that is out there on the market now, what are the checkboxes, and should they be unchecked, or should some of them maybe left checked? If they're actually doing that, then it's not going to know anything about newer software. So it's going to become less and less viable as a useful piece of software. And I think most people, they're probably not installing software that came out 3 years ago or older. So one of the dangers of that is it might give you a false sense of security if you think that it's checking the boxes, unchecking the boxes for you, and you just blindly click next, 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 then maybe you're going to get some software that installs with the checkboxes not being unchecked. So I think at this point in time, I don't expect to see it change. Whether it works or not, I really don't know. I don't think it'll do any harm. But if I were you, I would continue to look for check boxes in software installs just in case Unchucky isn't doing anything for that particular installation. So I don't know if anybody else has a perspective on that, experience with Unchucky in the last while. Is it actually doing anything for you? I'd be really happy to hear if anybody has recent experience with Unchucky. And you can unmute yourself if you do.
Well, I'm using it, of course. That's why I posed the question.
Yeah.
But it's my only concern was I don't seem to see any indication that there's anything for it to do, so it's sitting there idly. And you've raised the point many times that if something is not being updated, it's a vulnerability.
Yeah.
And it's a target for hackers.
Potentially, sure.
Yeah. So it may not be unchecky that may do something bad, but someone may tell it to do something bad.
True. If somebody finds a vulnerability in it and exploits it. Now, one of the things is I think most attackers are going to be going after, you know, more popular software than unchecky. So the likelihood of people looking for vulnerabilities and finding them in unchecky is probably not huge. The guy who wrote it does security software, so one would hope that he would periodically look at his own code, but who knows? You're absolutely correct. In terms of it, impact on the system, I've looked at it and it uses zero resources. I mean, the amount of memory it uses, a couple of megabytes of memory is it. Uses no CPU. You know, so it's just sitting there doing basically nothing until hopefully it jumps into action if you install something. But I haven't noticed anything in my own experience where it did uncheck boxes or didn't uncheck boxes. I don't know.
That's another thing, Chris. It strikes me there's not that many pieces of software out there these days that do this malicious checking of stuff like that.
Well, I get it. I think there's still a lot that install things that are not necessarily malicious. Like I've seen a lot of things that want to install McAfee, you know, products and things like that. I still see a lot of that.
That's pretty malicious. Well, they're going to give you for 30 days and then they want money and they'll just fuck the hell out of you until you...
Well, actually, the McAfee usually when it's a security scan thing. It's not their full antivirus or anything, but it's some security scanner that they have, and I've seen that multiple times over the last few years that installations of things like you know free stuff, you know Java or stuff like that will have the check boxes for things like McAfee's security scanner, and it's pre-checked for you. So there is still some stuff. I haven't seen a lot where they're changing your web browser's homepage or search engine. I haven't seen a lot of that. But these extra programs that are going to help you out, I still see some of that.
Well, the other one that was really bad was installing a toolbar. So you've got like 7 toolbars on your browser.
Yeah. Fortunately, the biggest on that was the ask.com toolbar, and they've gone away, so I used to see that all the time, the ask.com. Crazy. Anyhow, I don't know. Take it for what it's worth, but if anybody does come up with some you know real-life experience on this that it actually did uncheck boxes for you or didn't uncheck boxes for you when you were using the program, fire it off to suggestion box at opcug.ca and we'll include it as an update on a future Q&A.
Okay. So talking about headphones, Tucker, this is yours too, Chris.
Okay. I'm just going to post in a huge number of links on this one into the chat window. So yeah, we got this question came in having stutter on a very specifically the Sony WH-1000 XM3 Bluetooth headphones, and the stutter was when using Zoom, and it worked mostly well when connected to Android or listening to music on the PC using FUBAR 2000. So I did a bit searching around on it, and I found in actual fact, seems to be a lot of people that have had this problem with this. So here's a bunch of links. You know, there was answers.microsoft.com. So that's the main consumer-oriented blog type thing at Microsoft. So there was some people having that problem in there. No real solution that I saw on there. Reddit had some stuff on there talking about stuttering with that particular headphones. And then on the Sony site itself, there was some talk about it as well. Heygents.com in Australia had some comments on it, and there was the link that I had there is a slightly different model, but it actually uses the same noise canceling chip in it, which I presume is the main or one of the main components in it. And then on Linus Tech Tips, there was a comment as well in their blog. And the solution one person found was that they used a new Bluetooth 5 USB stick on their computer to make the connection to the headset, and they said that fixed the problem for them. So take that for what it's worth, but there were a lot of people that seemed to be having this particular problem. So then if we looked at Sony website, and they had a couple of comments on it, and they said make sure the headset is set to priority on stable connection mode, and the link there is where they talk about that and how to go about doing that. They talk about removing obstacles between the antenna in the computer and the antenna in the headset, and the little graphic there shows you where the actual antenna is. It's in the left earpiece, and so they say don't put your body between you and the other antenna. Or a wall or a microwave oven. They talked about having anything that's on 2.4 gigahertz Wi-Fi within 10 meters you should avoid. Good luck with that if you you want to be 10 meters away from your Wi-Fi connection. And then they had another thing saying to change wireless playback quality settings or fix wireless playback mode to SBC. And they said to see operating instructions. I didn't have a manual for it, so I really don't know. So that Sony recognizes that there are some issues around that as well. Some of it obviously very generic in terms of removing obstacles between the antennas. That's sort of, you know, go away, don't bug us. It must be your environment that is causing the problem. So there was nothing in anywhere that I could find that Sony was admitting that they had a fundamental problem with their headset. There was no indication I really saw how many people were having this problem. There was lots of things I found, but is it, you know, 100th of 1% of users, or is it 5% of users? I don't know. So
actually, I'm the one who asked the question, and I have the headphones on, and you're listening to them now. And I don't have the problem when I'm listening to my phone or I'm listening to music to Fubar 2000 or on my PC either. So it seems to be something connected with Zoom. And I went into the Zoom settings and I turned off all the audio enhancements and echo stuff, and it still didn't make much difference. And I'm still hearing stuttering, but I was hearing stuttering also with my other headphones, which are also Bluetooth.
Yeah, so it
seems to be a Zoom thing with regard to Bluetooth. I mean, I have other headphones that I have used that are wired, that then they work quite well. I don't have any problems, but with Bluetooth, there seems to be some problem with Zoom.
Yeah, but you say that the latest Zoom client seems to fix it. I mean, we don't hear any stuttering now. So,
well, I'm glad you can't hear any stuttering on my microphone. That's good. I don't know if there was any before, but there's stuttering when I'm listening to it.
Oh, so, I see. Okay.
So let me turn off my sunset alarm. It's 5 minutes to sunset, I hope you realize.
So you're still getting stuttering on the earpieces?
That's right.
Okay.
And it seems to be worse on the Sony than it is on the Jabra. But it's not, you know, really bad, but if my sound comes out to you guys by the microphone, then it's probably okay. The stuttering is minor when I hear it.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah,
it's nice to have it off.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, your microphone is very clear on this one. Your other one, there was some stuttering or dropping out with the other one, but this one seems to be very solid. So.
I attended a conference, a Zoom conference this weekend. It was a fitness thing. And they gave a presentation on how to do a Zoom fitness class. And one of the things that they mentioned was that the Bluetooth earbuds and that just it was unreliable to use Bluetooth for this kind of a presentation, even though intuitively that would be what you would think would be the best thing. And they cited all sorts of odd things that could happen, like your son signed on and started playing games in the middle of your and it would affect it, or, you know, something happened, or someone used the microwave. And it seemed to be Zoom specific, what they were talking about, but they said probably Bluetooth, if you're trying to, you know, do a class, probably Bluetooth is not your best bet.
I tell you, wireless
helps, but just
yeah. Well, I think it helps in that if nothing else, you know, stop banging your head against the wall helps if you're getting a headache from it, and if people are having problems with, you know, wireless technologies, maybe wireless technologies can be set aside in some circumstance. Personally, I would always rather be on wired connections on everything rather than wireless connections. Wireless, I mean, you talk about printers, you talk about, you know, computer connections, you talk about peripherals. I've had more problems with wireless keyboards than I can shake a stick at. I have never had a problem with a wired keyboard. You know, it just always works reliably. I've had wireless keyboards that all of a sudden I'm typing and just no characters are going through, you know, and I have to turn it off, turn it back on again. I would always rather be on a wired connection than a wireless connection.
Jocelyn is echoing that point. He says he had difficulty with a Bluetooth speaker and he finally used a wired connection instead and that solved the problem.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. You would think that somehow the industry would have found a way to deal with it by now. I don't know. Maybe it's just the nature of the beast. I don't know.
It varies a lot. I mean, I have Bluetooth speakers that I use with my phone and I don't have a problem. I use these headphones with my phone. I don't have a problem. I use these headphones with my PC with playing music from FUBAR. And no problem. It's just Zoom or it seems to interfere. Zoom and Bluetooth have some, presumably some kind of timing problem that is interfering.
Yeah, very odd, very frustrating.
It seems to work for some people. Micheline says, my Sony headset works okay with the TV as I walk anywhere around the house.
You have a Sony Bluetooth headset?
Oh, it doesn't say Bluetooth. It just says Sony headset.
And you can walk anywhere around the house?
Apparently.
Even to the furthest reaches?
I'm just reading it verbatim here. As I walk anywhere.
Anywhere in
the house. I think it says.
Anywhere in the house.
Well, you must have a long cord.
No cord. Why?
It's wild.
Like Lawrence commented, he said, amen to Chris's comments. Unfortunately, we've already been wirelessly assimilated. Yeah. Resistance is not futile.
Moving on to another related topic. He has a follow-up on using video with Zoom. So you'll need to share your screen, B. And you have to unmute yourself.
There we go. All right. Let's see if I can do this. This looks good. Oh, no.
Yeah, that's good. That's good? Got it. Yep.
Okay. So last week, you'll remember, I had no video until the very end when I clicked it and it worked. And I'd had problems with both my classes, And it was very random. Sometimes it would work, sometimes it wouldn't. At first it worked when I signed on to somebody else's, like when I was a participant, but didn't work when I was the host. And, I do have a Zoom license. I tried the Zoom people. They were really unhelpful. They basically said, due to COVID, we're basically not answering anybody's questions. Here are a bunch of links. So I went through all the links and I did all the things that you guys suggested last week. I uninstalled and reinstalled Zoom about six times. I started and I restarted and shut down a whole bunch of times. I uninstalled some apps that were using the camera because I thought they might be interfering. I closed things that were running in the background that would use the camera. I checked the camera on other apps and it worked. What would happen was sometimes it wouldn't let me even join the audio. It would just go non-responsive then. Sometimes it let me get through the audio. Sometimes magically it just actually let me in, but then I would try it again and it wouldn't. So I was getting pretty, I loaded in and unloaded and I tried everything I could think of. Couple of interesting things I found when I went to the privacy settings in settings. So the camera was, can you see? Yeah. Okay. So yeah. When I went to, so Zoom meetings was allowed. But I noticed that even after I shut down and signed out, it still claimed that it was using, that Zoom was using the camera. And so it wouldn't let me use the camera in anything else, and it wouldn't let me reuse the camera in Zoom. It said it's already being used. So apropos to Chris's comment that when you shut down, it keeps the current settings, and when you restart, it changes them. I noticed if I shut down, it came back still saying it was currently in use. And when I restarted, it came back not saying it was in use, but giving me the wrong date for the last access. So something was definitely not kosher there. So finally, and the other thing, I went into my Bitdefender and I noticed that Zoom was there. I unclicked it, like I disallowed it and allowed it again, and that didn't help. The other thing I did was I uninstalled a bunch of things, some things that I probably shouldn't have uninstalled. And then I got desperate and went on the internet. I looked at all the Zoom things, but I looked, just Googled. And I found somebody who said that they had a problem after their Kaspersky updated, and that they had to turn off their Kaspersky altogether in order to get Zoom to work. So I went in to back into Bitdefender, and so it didn't help when I was on the webcam protection site and installed it and uninstalled it. But if I went to settings, where it says webcam protection, and turn that off completely, everything works fine. So, and the other interesting thing was, if once I'm on Zoom and it's all working, I can go back into Bitdefender and turn the webcam protection on, and I don't lose anything. I can still get in and out of my camera, turn it on and off. So then I thought, okay, how did that happen? And I went back and looked through the Bitdefender update log, and I found that just before I had the problem that Tuesday, this here is what it had downloaded and installed. And I have no idea what any of that stuff is. So I wondered if anybody had any idea if any of those things created the problem. But since I mentioned this, I found other people who had the same problem. My daughter, who is using a university system in Scotland, she said when their antivirus updated. She lost her Teams. She couldn't see her video in Teams, and she tried everything. And finally, the tech support said, this is going to sound ridiculous, but go in, disallow it, and then allow it again. So uninstall Zoom or Teams and then reinstall it. And she did that, and it worked. So I have no idea why, but that seems to be the solution. And touch wood, so far, every time I've tried it, it has continued to be the solution. And I hope I didn't jinx tomorrow's class just by telling you guys this like I did last time.
Well, first off, in terms of the what is shown there for the Bitdefender update, and it says it updated those files, basically that's just the program update. So the DLLs are dynamic link libraries. Those are basically program code. And so that was just the files that were updated in order to come up to the latest version of Bitdefender. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of what it is actually doing, this is one of the reasons why I tend to shy away from these security suites that give you all kinds of extra functionality. I prefer to just, generally speaking, to just go with antivirus, just anti-malware protection, which is required. But do I need video and audio protection? Personally, I don't think I need that. What is the danger that they are protecting me from? And I suspect that a great deal of these security suites, they're just trying to give you something that will convince you to send them money every year. Well, really, I mean, they know that free antivirus is available. So if you are just looking for antivirus, you can go with Windows Defender, that's built into Windows 10. It comes in the box. It doesn't cost you anything extra. It works. It updates fine. It has low system resources and so forth. So if they want to make money, they have to give you something extra. So they'll look to things like, well, what if an attacker, takes over your video camera or something like that? Well, we can protect that because we can block applications from getting access to the webcam. Well, maybe that's what they did and they didn't do it properly and they happened to block Zoom from getting access to the webcam. Now, I strongly suspect that the next time you get an update from Bitdefender, this problem will go away because I'm sure they're getting complaints about it and they're probably in the background going like, oh, yeah, we blew it and let's fix that. And the next time we send out an update, it'll fix the problem for people. And they probably will never admit to the fact that they actually blew it in this particular update and they caused problems for people. So my personal opinion on things like that, if you find a solution, I would just leave off that webcam protection period. Are you really concerned about, an attacker getting control of your webcam?
No, not really. I'm not doing anything crazy in front of it anyway.
But the likelihood of you having somebody actually, attack your computer in that manner, I think the odds are probably pretty low to begin with. But that goes with a lot of the things that they will throw into these sort of security suites. They call it total security. Yeah, but total security can come at a cost.
Well, it's been complaining about some emails I get that I've had for years and years from, reliable sources like Loblaws and some other. The other day it was something really, really basic, and they give me these warnings and say, something infectious is happening, and you look in. And I had a communication with them about it, quite a long one, and in the end they didn't really solve it. They just basically said, we fixed it, but we didn't. They didn't.
Yeah. I mean,
Justin suggesting that maybe that new member of parliament might disagree with your premise. he might have appreciated more security.
Well, this wouldn't have solved his problem because he did it himself. So if you want to be protected.
Lawrence says if a hacker has access to your webcam, you've got bigger problems to deal with.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. It's that sort of thing, though, that has always scared me away from these, you know, total security packages and things like that. Mm-hmm. They're trying to do some things that maybe are pretty aggressive in terms of anything that, you know, at all looks suspicious, they'll block it. And it's like your emails, that it may have looked suspicious to them, but I think they're being overly aggressive, and it's costing you. So, yeah.
Okay, well, that's great. I didn't know any of that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting problem that you had, and I kudos to finding the solution on it, because they're hard to find the solutions to things like that.
It was just lucky.
Yeah. Well, perseverance, I think, rather than luck.
Okay, so we're at that time. I said there'd be time for other questions, and we certainly do. So if anybody has any other questions, now's the time to ask them. And there's one in the chat window from Michelin. Michelin's looking for an editing program that will show HTML code in one window and the output in a kind of a browser window in a second window. So you can see both the code and the output at the same time. Now, all the HTML editors I've ever seen, and as Tom and I were talking earlier, they work on a toggle basis. So you have the two windows, but you have to toggle between them. You don't see them both at the same time. I'm not aware of anyone that works where you've got both at the same time. So if anybody knows of such a beast, unmute your microphone and tell us all about it.
Yes, I answered Micheline in the blog. I have tried out some time ago, Amaya from W3C website. And you have the browser at the top, and you can have the code at the bottom, and you do a change at the top and it shows at the bottom. So it's free. It's on their website. It hasn't been updated since 2012, but it works. It's full of information about making websites.
It works under Windows 10?
It works under Windows 10, yes.
Okay, because I know that was one of the comments in the members forum that there was no indication that it specifically worked under Windows 10.
That's because it was last updated prior to Windows 10.
Mm-hmm.
The many browsers have a web developer mode that lets you see with the WIG and at the same time look at the code behind it. And they are getting more and more powerful, those web developer that are provided by the browsers. So that's also another option. You have the JavaScript, they have all kind of different mode and different screens. So it's quite powerful, but not necessarily easy to use if you are just a beginner.
And there's Sarah's just posting the Amaya link into the chat window.
So do we have any other questions?
Bob Harris just placed it in to the chat. Internet radio, I guess it's obvious, but if a radio station doesn't allow streaming from other countries, activating your VPN works well. And that actually could be really useful even on free VPNs. Like I'm just thinking TunnelBear, which is a Canadian provider of VPN service, and they give you a limited amount of traffic per month free. But if you're just doing radio, you can probably get quite a few hours for, you know, not much traffic coming over that VPN connection. So that could be an option as well. Or if you paid for a VPN with unlimited traffic, then certainly that would solve that problem. And Claudette asks, do you know what will be happening with Google Photos storage and its costs as of June? We had something at Q&A, I believe, just a while ago about Google Photos. There was a comment, I think, just a couple of weeks ago about
yes,
that.
It was when I presented, I think. There was comments in chat that it was all going to change in June. I don't know if it was just Lynn or...
I can't remember who...
It was me, but I didn't... I didn't research. I think what Chris answered was more complete than what I could answer on that.
Well, Greg, my comments are pretty ad hoc as well because I haven't really looked into it either. So I don't know if anybody wants to take that on for next week to actually do a little bit of a couple of slides or some information on exactly what's going to happen with Google Photo Storage. I know that they're putting some limits on, and there are some ramifications for whether you will lose some of your existing information and so forth. So if anybody wants to take that on for next week, speak up, and we'll reserve some time for you.
There's a follow-up question for you, Linda.
Yes.
What would you recommend as an alternative?
Well, there's obviously lots of other places you can do the free storage, but the Google Photos seem to have some functionality. I have not used it myself. So I can take a look and see if there's other free storage places that would have the same kind of search capabilities that Google Photos seem to have. I'm happy to snoop around a bit.
Claudette, are you mostly interested in just pure storage, or are you looking at other functionality that Google Photos gives you, like editing capabilities and searching and tagging and things like that? Because one of the things you can go, if all you're looking for is bulk storage, although there are some bits of pain in the butt about it, Degoo will give you 100 gigabytes for free. Now, the biggest gotcha on that. Well, there's two big gotchas, I think, on that. One, there's no free automatic synchronization between your computer and Degoo, so you have to just manage it through a website interface of uploading and downloading and so forth. But another limitation is that you have to log in at least every 90 days or else they will remove all your photos, or they say they can. But apparently as long as you log in at least once every 90 days, they won't delete anything from it on you. Another thing is Google. You could actually create multiple Google accounts. You know, so it gets a little awkward managing multiple Google accounts, but that could be an option for you as well. That's Degoo, Degoo.com is the storage that I was talking about. That's the biggest one I have found, and it was a member of the OPCUG who pointed that one out to me. That's the biggest I found in terms of free storage. Of course, if you're willing to pay for storage, there's lots and lots of options out there that will give you terabytes if you want.
Yes. I guess I have a lot of photos right now in Google, and I'm wondering how I'm going to deal with them.
Yeah. Is it just storage, pure storage is all you want, or other functionality that comes out of Google Photos?
I'm going to need to use more if I intend to work on genealogy a bit and getting the family photos gathered and whatnot. So going to need to do more than just storage, do a little bit of editing, but not major like Photoshop.
Yeah. Okay. I guess if you like the functionality of Google Photos, if we can get more information for next week, we'll do so. If somebody wants to step forward on that, that would be helpful. But otherwise, the other option would be if you create multiple Google accounts, each one of them will give you 15 gigabytes of storage. So,
yeah. pretty awkward.
Yeah, I mean, it is. But the other question is, your 15 gigabytes free is shared across everything that you use Google for. So your email, Gmail and things like that count against that 15 gigabytes. But 15 gigabytes, that's a fair amount of room. So are you really running up against that limit?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Chris, the degoo.com, it's DEGOO?
Yep.
Okay, and the question is, can you store videos there?
Yes.
Oh, Linda just answered yes.
So. Yeah, I store videos on it.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, it's just file storage, so you can store anything you want on there.
And Eldon says there was a webinar today on Dototech about Google Photos. And you can view it as long as you go to the site in less than a week. So if you go to Dototech,
how do you spell that, Alan?
It's in the chat.
It's Dotto as in D-O-T-T-O, Tech, all one word, Dototech.
Eldon, I presume it's dototech.com is the URL for their site?
I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
I tried to pull the, while I was typing, I tried to pull the URL up, but it's put out by Steve Dotto. You may recognize him from about 15 years ago. He had a different kind of show on, and now he has this. Steve Dototech, every Wednesday he has a webinar for an hour, and it's free. You can pick up quite a bit of information from it. And I'm sorry, I think if you just Google Steve Dotto or Dotto Tech,
it's dototech.com.
Yeah,
there you go. Thank you, Alan.
Well, and Greg found it too, and Chris found it too. Everybody found it.
It's well hidden.
Does anybody want to take on going and watching that Dototech about Google Photos and report next week at Q&A?
I'll watch it.
Okay. Linda says she's willing to take it on. So thank you very much, Linda. So we'll have something for Q&A next week.
That's great. Thank you.
And Fred is saying he's also interested in a photo system to store photos, negatives, scan negatives, cameras and phones, so he can search, sort by date, tags and that sort of stuff. So I guess that's what we were talking about, the functionality of Google Photos and other products like that.
Yeah, I think so. I personally have never used Google Photos, so I don't have any experience with it at all.
If I could point out something, I have a home NAS, which is just storage, but there are applications for these things. Mine is a Netgear NAS, and there's a whole whack of custom-made applications that can be installed on it, and photo storage is one of the most popular things on the web, internet, whatever you want to call it. And there's all kinds of photo organizers that can be installed for this NAS, and that's just the Netgear. And there's several other manufacturers, Western Digital, Synology, somebody else.
Yeah.
Anywho, a home storage solution is often the most elegant for doing mass storage and editing, because you can pick and choose the software you may want to put on it, as opposed to using whatever a cloud provider allows you to use. So I'm going to throw a little idea out there. Whatever bulk storage solution someone settles on, Google Photos is an excellent tool for its convenience of backing up your photos instantly. You take a picture with your camera or your webcam, whatever, and boom, it's synced to the cloud. So it's great to maintain that, but maybe once a week you want to go in and offload all your Google Photos to your bulk storage solution and free up that space on Google Photos for the next crop of victims that you collect. So the idea of moving away from Google Photos is not a great idea because it's still ultimately very, very convenient with the technology we've got at the moment. Yeah, but it's not great for bulk. And I'm suggesting that a home storage solution can be really flexible and inexpensive too.
But if you use an external drive like you're suggesting, I have Seagate drives, how easy is it to use the photo software in there? Like, I think my feeling is that it would be a lot slower than if you had it on your computer, for example.
It could be. But I'll offer another suggestion. Everybody's got a home router. And most of these routers have got a USB plug on them for a printer. Well, instead of plugging a printer into it, because they're all wireless now anyway, plug a drive into your home router and you've got a local NAS, a local storage device that you can access over your home internet as an external drive from whatever device you're using at the moment.
That sounds interesting, except my computer is way far off from where the router is. It's pretty difficult to put it somewhere else than in the basement right now. So we'd have to find a way to get wires through the house somehow.
Well, you shouldn't have to. You plug it into the router, the drive into the router, and then you access it across the network just from your laptop the way you access the internet.
Well, I see.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And if you want blazing fast speeds, if you can afford it, get a big SSD and plug that in.
Yeah.
And by gosh, you'll edit just like the speed of light.
We had a comment in the chat from Stan saying that 100 gigabytes on Google Drive cost $2. It's actually $2.79 Canadian. I just looked it up, and that's per month. So it's still not necessarily a bad price, but it adds up. So
yeah, no, that's not bad actually.
Yeah,
but it's still only 100 gigabytes, so.
Yeah.
I don't think I can put everything in there.
Well, this is a home PC users group. Start using your stuff at home. Get out of the cloud.
Well, I do have photos also on iCloud with because I was using a Mac before. Or I still have my Mac, but so I have to transfer those photos and get everything kind of aligned. I was wondering, well, if anybody knows if Google Drive recognizes double photos, like will they still take in a double photo, or will it be duplicated if there is photos that are already into?
Yeah, I don't know. In terms of the using it under Google Photos, it may give you some additional capabilities for deduping your data or something like that, maybe. But just in terms of the raw storage of Google Drive, it wouldn't. So that wouldn't help you there. Do you happen to have a Microsoft Office 365 subscription?
I do, and there's option for storage there as well.
Yeah, because they give you a terabyte of storage. Again, it's just raw storage, but it gives you a terabyte of storage with your Office 365 subscription.
Yeah, the editor is not nearly as good, I don't think, as the as what we get with Google.
Yeah.
Micheline is saying she has 4 gigabytes on OneDrive out of a max of 5, but it takes forever to download the data. Now, isn't that one of the problems, that it must take more than forever to upload the data? So if you're going to switch cloud providers, how do you transfer the data?
It can take a long time. And if you have limits on that, you're paying over certain, like right now I'm on Rogers Ignite, which is unlimited bandwidth. And it's actually, I'm paying for 150 megabit and I'm actually getting 500 megabit right now. And download, it's interesting because at 500 megabit, I find copying a file from one drive to another on my local system takes longer than downloading something from the internet. It's incredible how fast 500 megabit per second really is. It's amazing. But yeah, that's something certainly to be keep in mind, especially if you are changing providers for, you know, 100 gigabytes or 200 gigabytes. It can take you a while to transfer that information from one provider to another.
Yeah. And I read that it's not easy to transfer information from the iCloud. I think you have to do it in batches. A little bit at a time and put it on your computer first, and then you can transfer it to a hard drive or somewhere else.
Yeah.
I think that Microsoft Photos would do something similar. I haven't tried it, but a couple of days ago I got an offer from Microsoft to install it on my Android phone, and it synced my photos right away to my OneDrive in the cloud. And I think that there's an editor, and you can put both videos and photos on there, and I think there's an editor with that as well.
So yeah, there is one, but I think it's not quite as good as the Google one from what I read. I must say I didn't use much of it yet. I do have some photos there, but I haven't really played with it much yet.
Okay, I think we've run quite a bit over the time now, so I think we'll have more on Google Photos with Linda's input next week. But I think now we should let Alan go through the wrap-up.
Okay. This came on Twitter fairly recently. Microsoft's going to change the fonts in something or other, Calibri, I guess. So they're asking for your suggestions on the 5 that they pick, which one you like best. But of course, you won't be able to answer that until after the 12th of May, when Chris has told you everything you need to know about typography.
And I will have something to say about the 5 new typefaces that Microsoft has come up with. I'll have something included in the presentation on those.
So this is our next regular club meeting, second Wednesday of the month, the 12th of May, 7:30. And the tech cafes don't start until June, but the first one on June the 7th at 4 p.m. is Lawrence talking about password phrasing. And we have a meeting before any of those next week, Wednesday, May the 5th. Will be our next Q&A. So if you have additional questions or topics that you want to share with the group, please send the information to suggestion box. And thanks for attending, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks very much for showing up, folks. We had, I think, a total of 45 at a peak today, so a very good turnout. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was great.
Thanks so much.